From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we examine the rise of right-wing populist movements in Europe and how it compares to current politics in the United States.
Then how art therapists know that using art is helping their clients get through their mental health challenges.
They get better, and they meet their goals. I mean, we have a treatment plan. It's not like we're just kind of pulling out the art supplies and sitting and making art. We have goals, and it's very systematic.
And how a UWM professor is helping young refugees adjust to life in American schools by creating books.
It's a book that they get to take home about their first, their new school. Often it's their very first school in the United States. So I want them to be able to take that home and hold on to that as a memory.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. From 89.7 WUWM, this is Lake Effect. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Nationalist political parties have been on the rise in Europe for some time. While the party platform specifics differ between countries, these radical right-wing populist movements tend to be anti-immigration and anti-European Union and to favor economic protectionism.
Unlike broader political movements like fascism or socialism, populism on either side of the political spectrum essentially says those in power don't have our best interests at heart, so we need to get rid of them, kick the bums out. The problem is very often little thought is given to what to replace the bums with.
Irene Braum is the executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, which is based in Washington, D.C. The nonpartisan think tank offers a transatlantic perspective on global issues, including the rise of right-wing populism in Europe. She joined me in the studio back in March. Irene Braum, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for inviting me.
In the past few years, we've seen the rise of political parties like UKIP in England, the National Front in France, the People's Union in Germany. There are many others. And they and other right-wing populist parties across Europe seem to be flourishing. And I guess the first question to you is why? Why is this phenomenon happening?
Well, I think, first of all, you said it rightly. I think in Europe we have seen populist parties for many years now. And they are on the rise for different reasons, because every country in Europe is facing different difficulties. I think if you kind of look across the line, a lot of people, and that is also if you look at the surveys, fear uncontrolled migration. I think in addition, there's a fear of Islam. And also, people feel that they are kind of being left behind because of the globalization, people losing their jobs because of the digitization, and see a decrease in income and a rising inequality.
So what do the populist parties offer the citizens of their country who are voting for them? What do they promise that can change in the face of that globalization?
Well, they promise very simple things, but which are often very difficult to implement. If you look at the populist party in the Netherlands, he basically promises the people to stop uncontrolled immigration, but also basically to throw out a lot of people who have entered the Netherlands on as a refugee in the last few years. In France as well, you know, Marine Le Pen is promising people that, first of all, they would leave the European Union because they think, like Mr. Trump in the U.S., that they can make better deals, trade deals, if they're out of Europe. So it's often very simple solutions, but then if you dig a little bit deeper, they will be just incredibly difficult to realize.
Great Britain actually did it. They voted to leave. Brexit is happening, and there's supposedly a timeline when that's going to happen. And do you think that that was fueled also by fear of immigration and of economic issues?
Well, I think there's several issues. They played it very hard on anti-Europe. And, you know, why can we not decide on a lot of issues ourselves anymore? But the decision is being taken in Brussels. There was a fear of migration, but coming from the European Union, within the European Union. So there were a lot of people from the Eastern European countries which have moved to the UK. And I think that has kind of created a backlash against migration. So there again, it is very different. But if you look at the numbers, only 38% of the people voted to leave. A lot of people didn't even go to vote. And I think a lot of people only realized later that, you know, the Brexit, the leavers had won the campaign.
The people who are the heads of these populists, and these are right-wing populist parties. We're not talking about left-wing in this case, because I know there's different kinds of populism across the world, but these are particularly hardline right-wing groups. If they are offering simple solutions that are very difficult to actually implement, promises that may not be able to be kept, what happens if they get into power? I mean, what happens to the people who voted and then are let down by these parties?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. There are already some right-wing populist leaders in charge in some of the Eastern European countries. And if you look in Slovakia, they had for a few years a right-wing populist. And he didn't deliver what he promised. And then also because he came into power, that reunited all the others and they kind of formed a bloc. So in the next elections, he was basically voted out. So maybe people wake up. I think for us, if I look at the Netherlands, Germany and France, because that are the three countries where we have upcoming elections this year, let's take the first one, the Netherlands. If Geert Wilders wins and he is able to form a government, because you always need several parties in the Netherlands to form a government. He has basically, although he has been member of the parliament for many years, he doesn't really have an entourage which is used in legislating. So I think it will have a backlash. If they then don't deliver the next election cycle, they will be out.
So what happens, though? What kind of damage can they do if they do get in? What kinds of things do you fear would happen if too many of these populist leaders take power?
Well, I think looking at the Eastern European countries, fear is definitely a limitation of freedom of the press. And you already see it happening in the Eastern European countries. If I look at France, a real fear is a referendum on the European Union, and will we have a Frexit after the Brexit? And that would potentially lead to the end of the European Union, because France is now the sole big military power within the European Union. Now the UK is leaving. So what will be left? You know, Germany is not a military power within the
European
Union.
Not in the same way, no. What is it about these kinds of movements? I mean, on the surface, populism sounds like a good thing. It sounds like people uniting to say, you know, this government isn't serving us. We need to take matters into our own hands. It's kind of what the United States was founded on, the idea that we should have say over our future. But these seem to not be quite so positive. And so what happens, do you think? Where does the change happen from this is a good idea that people want to be involved in their own futures to the kind of right-wing parties that we're seeing and platforms that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think these right-wing platforms, I think they operate in a very clever way. First of all, they're already reaching out directly to the population. And if you take the different right-wing or populist movements in Europe, they act a little bit the same as Trump does in the U.S. You know, they use social media a lot. They use the social media a lot to target their voters' base. So the voters now already think or are under the impression someone is listening to me because I have this, they believe this direct communication. I think, of course, in the end, it will reveal that it's much more difficult once you're really governing a country. And so they are using, they're kind of fueling the anti-political establishment sentiment even more. Similar like in the US, this hate against the mainstream media. So they are, I think they have, in a way, a very clever strategy. And again, you know, Marine Le Pen, She's not a new kid on the block. She did this for many years. It's a very well prepared campaign. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands as well. He's one of the most oldest member of the parliament in the Netherlands. So they know how to play the voters' base very, very well. I'm not sure whether they afterwards also know how to keep satisfying their voters' base, and because they have to collaborate with other political forces, unless, you know, they win with such a big majority. But it doesn't seem that Marine Le Pen will have kind of 60% of the voters, or Geert Wilders will have 67 seats in the parliament.
And that is something that is different, certainly, than the way we govern here. You're talking about a parliamentary system where collaboration is kind of built in to the system. And our system here is much more opposites, two opposites fighting, or it seems that that's the way it is. Do you think that because of the very nature of the parliamentary system, there's less danger from these kinds of populist movements?
Yeah, there's less. It will take them a longer time to basically get there where they want. Take the example of the AfD in Germany. I think the latest polls, they polled 12%. Their first aim now is getting seats in the national parliament. So at federal
level. And how many
level,
do they need? 15% or?
The threshold is 15%. So I think they will probably, you know, win some seats. And they see that as a first step. So it's a very, very long way. And then there are other what we call kind of forces which might block them. But still, I think the fact that they are running, that they are extremely popular, is really not a good sign.
You mentioned, of course, the elections here and President Trump. Did you in Europe see that happening here? What was the viewpoint as the election was upcoming and the fact that he did win on a populist platform?
I think people didn't see it coming. But then also in Europe, a lot of people didn't see Brexit coming. I think if you would talk to the people like a year and a half ago, and you would say Donald Trump is running for president, they would all laugh and say, you know, this is a joke. Before the primaries start, he will be out. So I think it was kind of a wake-up call. People react in a way like, oh, what is happening now? The world is changing. And the Europeans often forget that we already have also a lot of populism in Europe, and that is not something which is new. So they were quite shocked. They are worried because also he does not give the impression that he appreciates the transatlantic relations like previous presidents did. So I think it also goes much further than maybe the U.S. having a populist president, but also what does it mean for the Western order?
Do you think that the fact that Trump was elected has emboldened?
Yes. It has definitely emboldened Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and it has emboldened Marine Le Pen. Although in France, the people are very anti-American, and a lot of people don't, even Marine Le Pen voters, don't like Mr. Trump. In Germany, it has had the opposite effect, and the AfD has gone down in the polls because of President Trump. So that is, it's very curious. There are different effects on the outcome of the elections here in the United States.
Do you think that this tendency, it seems to be a very human tendency to circle our wagons, you know, we all are tribal in some way or other. Do you think this is cyclical? Are we in a time where somehow everybody seems to want to retract as opposed to reach out across the pond or across the world?
Yeah, the world has become more accessible. And so in a way, everybody's personal world has become much larger, much bigger. And I think then people have a tendency is in kind of having their own safe space. There was recently a study which was published in the Netherlands where they basically asked the people, so what is your fear? What is your fear of this globalization? And a majority replied, we fear the loss of our identity. So I think, yes, people that is something which people are scared of.
What do you think is the answer to that? How do people who don't believe in populism and who do think that everyone has a place at the table, how do they fight that very human fear of losing who they are?
Well, there is apparently a real disconnect in between the people who rule the country and the citizens. So I think there needs to be a real reflection. How do you kind of stimulate this interaction? How do you give also the people who do not live in a big city, give them the impression that they are heard, that their concerns are heard? That is very important, how you do it. I mean, we are at the Bertelsmann Foundation, we are looking into maybe how can you use also these digital technologies in bringing the citizens closer to those who govern the countries and those who decide on legislation and make them more participate in a legislative process. And that doesn't mean that everything needs to be made subject to a referendum. I think, you know, that would be kind of, it's impossible to do. But I think there the politicians really need to reflect, you know, how can we also give those who believe that they are the forgotten ones? And that is not only, you know, we have seen that in the U.S., but in Europe as well. That is what people say. They forgot about us. You know, jobs have gone because robots came in. And people don't basically care what is happening to us.
It sounds to me, and it's very much like what happened here as well. Jobs have gone, and it's not because necessarily they went overseas, but because the technology's changed. And those particular jobs are not going to come back because those jobs no longer exist. Not because we don't care about you, but because they simply have changed. With the kind of work that your foundation is doing and other foundations like yours, how do you see making that communication happen, you know, with citizens and their governments and across governments and citizens? You know, I think that's important, too. It's not just within one country, but it's within the entire world.
Yeah. Maybe you should also have a much more local approach to certain problems, like more bottom up than top down. We strongly believe that because people are losing their jobs because of automation, and that will only be worse, you know, there are also a lot of jobs which are currently not affected, which will be affected in the next 10 years. So you need to have a plan, and either you kind of prepare the people and the workforce that they will not have, no longer have these traditional jobs, but maybe two or three jobs. But also you need to adapt the educational system and skill the people and give them the skills they need. What we see in the Netherlands is that the fear of globalization, people have lost their jobs, but then there are still a lot of jobs which are unfilled. So there is a level of unemployment, but there's also a lot of jobs which are for offer, which have a lot of difficulties in finding the right skilled people.
So it's training and education
as well. Yeah, training and education as well. And that takes time, and maybe also stimulating people and being more mobile and moving from one side to the country to the other. Well, in the Netherlands, that's not difficult because it's very small. But if you go to Germany or to France, you know, these are bigger countries. So how do you move then also people and make them mobile?
It doesn't seem like there's any easy answer to this.
No. Unfortunately not.
I want to thank you so much for taking a few moments to talk with us about it. I know we just scratched the surface, but Irene Brahm, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Irene Brahm is the executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington. The organization offers a transatlantic perspective on global challenges. Brahm was in Milwaukee last spring to talk about populism at UWM's Institute of World Affairs.
We'll take a quick break now and then head to Bayview to visit one of the centers of the growing art therapy world here in Milwaukee. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. For people dealing with mental illness, trauma, or other difficult life circumstances, there are many different forms of therapy professional counselors can use to help. Psychotherapy and other talk therapy techniques have been well used and accepted for more than 100 years.
But it has been much more recently that art therapy has come into its own in this country and taken its place among other more long-standing practices. There's an increasing number of art therapists practicing in Milwaukee, largely thanks to a growing program at Mount Mary University.
Five Milwaukee art therapists work out of a renovated space on South KK Avenue in Bayview. Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies is headed by Emily Nolan, who was in the first doctoral class to come out of Mount Mary's program. We stopped by the studio on a Monday earlier this year before any patients were there, and we spoke with Nolan and fellow therapists Ashley Smallwood and Caitlin Walsh. Thanks so much for having me here.
Lovely to have you.
Welcome to Bloom. Thank you.
Well, so before we really get into what you do with your clients, I'm curious to have both of you kind of reflect on your life as an artist and why you feel a connection between art and helping people through what you help people through.
Well, I'll start with that. I fell in love with photography at a really young age. And I also, growing up, had a neighbor who was diagnosed with autism. And I started working with him when I was probably, I think, in seventh grade, volunteering. We were repatterning his brain. And I fell in love with the ability to, you know, spend time helping people that needed it. And he had no verbal communication, so it was often things like letter boards or computer screens or...
So you were not doing art therapy with him at that point?
Not at that time, no, but I was really drawn to the ability to help people. And again, not having verbal skills, you needed another outlet to do that. So as I got older, I got my degree in fine arts, and then from there kind of got lost on what to do and found art therapy and literally fell in love with the idea that you can connect art making, which was my background, with the ability to help people. So that's where it kind of blossomed for me, and that was probably 10 years ago that I found that. So I'm new to the field.
I was in a totally different career field until my late 20s. And
what were you doing?
I actually owned a shop on the east side, a knitting store, so it was still creative. I always had this feeling that I'd be a good therapist. And my mother was a therapist, and she kind of talked to me about what a long road it is, because it's really a long road. She just wanted to be real with me, not that I wouldn't be good at it. I think she always knew that. So I found the art therapy and I was like, oh my gosh, it was like a light bulb moment that all my credits would transfer, everything was great, and I was an artist, and yeah, so it has been a long road. It's been wonderful. I think I feel lucky every day to come, and my clients have been great.
Well, and I gather the way this field works, there are a lot of people who are new to the field. What do we understand about this field today that 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 30 years ago that we didn't?
I think it's exactly what Ashley just said, in that it is able to help people in ways that traditional models of counseling or therapies would normally help. Yeah.
Okay, well, so we're in this studio, and can you kind of describe the space we are and really what happens here?
Sure. Right now, we're sitting in what is the community area, and this is a place where we invite the public in once a week to create art with art therapy interns that we have here on staff or volunteer art therapists who staff the space.
As in people are here for non-therapeutic reasons or therapeutic reasons that they don't have to necessarily get into? Or
yeah, therapeutic reasons that they don't necessarily have to disclose, and they don't need a diagnosis to be able to join in on that particular experience. And so it's an opportunity for the general public to engage in art therapy. And it goes beyond just that. In some ways, therapy in general, lots of different therapies, treatment of any kind is very privileged a lot of times to people who have insurance or who have jobs who can pay the out-of-pocket fees for those things. And so part of what Bloom's mission is to be able to provide opportunities to engage in art therapy for everybody.
So this is the community room. There are a number of smaller rooms that go off of this space.
Yeah, in those rooms, we typically do individual, family, small group, private sessions. And we have four different therapists here who see people all throughout the week in those sessions. And people pay out of pocket. They pay through their insurance. And we're also very excited to start working with wraparound care in Milwaukee.
How does someone know, you know, someone who's dealing with something, whether it's a mental illness issue or trauma or some other issue that would bring them to a therapist, that art is an appropriate and would be a useful part of the therapy for them?
I think some people know and some people don't know. I think some people seek us out. I'm finding that more and more people seek us out because they have heard of art therapy. They go online, they look up what's available in Milwaukee, and they come upon us. And so more and more referrals are coming for that specifically because they already know that they enjoy it. But what I've also seen is that, especially as I began my practice 15 years ago, that people came, and when I would, when we built a trusting relationship and I would ask them to do something creatively, they realized it got them out of their thinking brain and more into just allowing things to happen and seeing things visually. And so it was a different way of thinking. And it allowed them to access more things that maybe were guarded or that just weren't even available to them.
Is this the same thing or something different than the idea of mindfulness, say?
I think it's very similar to mindfulness, actually. I think that it's mindfulness in a different way. And there was actually an article that I just posted on Bloom's website or Facebook page about how art making is like meditating. And I think that from what I know of being a therapist and an art therapist, a lot of what we're doing is helping people create awareness. And it's the means or the approach that you do that with that changes.
You have to be open. You know, a lot of people sometimes when they hear art therapy have no idea what it is. So they're like thinking either we're an art teacher or that you're going to draw a picture and we're going to tell you what's wrong with you. And that is absolutely not what it is. So the people that walk in the door have to be open to, you know, being vulnerable and trying these new things. And that's why it's so important for us as clinicians to, like, you know, create that safe environment. Like Emily said, it is almost a form of mindfulness. Like when you get into the zone of making art, this happens almost on a daily basis in my office. All of a sudden, I'll look up at the clock and say, holy cow, that was already 45. Like, we got to clean up. And the kids always say, that went so fast. Like, I didn't even realize that our time was done. So I think that that kind of speaks to that, you know, being in like kind of a Zen moment where you lose everything and everything gets poured onto whatever you're creating at that time.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, you look in your office and you've got art supplies and a table covered in brown paper where people are presumably doing art, and you also have a comfortable chair and a comfortable couch. How do you go from, you know, I'm dealing with X to let's make art?
Yeah, so a lot of times what happens for me is that the client will come in and will initially sit down. And a lot of times I've realized that the kids go and they sit right at the table because they're ready to make art. But a lot of times the adults will come in and they'll sit on the couch and I'll sit in the chair and I'll just say, so tell me what's gone on with you since we've seen each other last. And we'll have what I call a check-in. And during that time, I'm assessing what's going on with the client and what might be helpful to do in this moment. And so then I'm also thinking about, okay, so what art task can I give this particular person that's going to help them right now? But then also thinking about what our long-term goals are and the goals that we, myself and the client, have created together. At that point, I'll say, okay, so this is what I'm thinking. And I'll give the client a choice and say, is that something you're interested in doing? Let's move over to the table. And then we'll move over to the table and we'll start creating whatever it is. And I sometimes will join and sometimes I will watch, depending on sort of what the client needs at that time.
Sometimes you'll join, meaning?
I'll make art too, yeah.
It almost sounds like you have, for lack of a better term, a matrix in your head.
For me, yeah, my brain really works that way. I'm sort of ruling things out as we're going and talking about them, and I'm very systematic and very much like, okay, so, but then also too, there's an intuitive side of it as well, but that's intuitive with clinical knowledge. And so when I'm making art next to the client too, I'm making art for the client.
you know, one of our biggest talents or whatever you want to call it is being able to be flexible. And so, you know, sometimes you'll have maybe an art directive or specific material set out of things that, hey, I thought this would work. This would be a good thing to do with this client. But when they come in, they're going to tell you exactly what they need. So, I mean, sometimes they'll verbally just say, like, I need to sit down and talk to you. Or sometimes their actions will show this isn't exactly what we should be doing today.
Help me understand, when you are making art alongside the clients and you're making it for the client, how are they using what you are making?
I have an example actually in the other room, and I can talk about this experience with a client. So I had a client who, mostly nonverbal, had experienced severe sexual abuse as a young kid, and I had seen him for years, and he was still very, very nonverbal, and it was very difficult to get him to talk. Not that he couldn't talk, it was just not something he did. And so he had painted a picture with some stencils and of a tree. And as I was painting with him, I was painting a portion of the tree. And when it came to the end of the session and we were finished, and we always put up our paintings side by side and look at them together up on the board that we have. And I said, well, you know, what do you think? And he usually nodded, you know, he would nod and say, oh, yeah, it's good. I would say, well, you know, I'm going to tell you about my picture. I said, this is a picture of a part of a tree. And this is me wanting to be a part and to be let into where your branches are and to be a part of this. And it was kind of like building that trust with him. Hey, I'm safe. I want to be a part of this, and I'm here, and I'm here with you.
Do each of you recognize the therapeutic nature when you're making art yourself, for yourself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Yes. I actually, in my bag, have my visual journals, and I keep them with me pretty much at all times. I do, and I recognize that when I have an overwhelming feeling or I'm dealing with something, the thing that I need to do absolutely the most is to go through and make my own art. Yeah.
Are there times as art therapists and professional counselors that you take a step back and say, maybe art isn't the best output or isn't the best way to get at these issues you're going through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's my personal belief that the client can sort of lead me in where they want to go. Sometimes I can tell that they need to be pushed a little bit, and then if they're resistant to art, sometimes I can tell that it would be really helpful, and I'll try to get them maybe more interested in it. But I never force. It's not, at least for me, it's not a requirement.
There's no, you will do a watercolor and it will be good for you.
No, not at all. That's not my style. I'm not forceful in that way. Not at all.
How do you know that you have done this right? How do you know that you've been able to help someone?
They keep coming back. They get better. And they meet their goals. I mean, we have a treatment plan. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're just,
right,
you know, kind of pulling out the art supplies and sitting and making art. We have goals, and it's very systematic.
I have a client who came for art therapy and was very hesitant. So there's ways that we can see that she's expanding and growing. Like, she would work on really small pieces of paper at first. She was super nervous about what it was going to look like and how to use the materials. And she just came in last week and wanted to use huge paper. We were doing all new materials. She was like super into it. And there was no hesitation there at all. And she was able to notice that she wasn't judging herself. She wasn't being negative. She was super open to the process. And she told me this whole story about how she was with a bunch of friends and they were doing this group kind of like, oh, making onesies for babies, you know, at a little a shower or something. And she was like, I was like leading everybody. I was totally utilizing all those things that we've talked about to not judge myself, not worry too much, to go with the process. So you can see through the actual art materials alongside of the treatment goals that we've set for them, which are much more like clinically worded than, oh, she's using larger paper. But even that is something that we would notice and assess and be like, oh, You're not trying to control everything so much. It doesn't have to be this tiny piece of paper and really rigid.
She felt some freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I imagine that you hear sometimes from skeptics, or you could understand how someone would say, well, how do you know that they're doing art is helping them any more than had they just gone through more traditional forms of therapy alone? But it sounds like there's a way to quantify the impact of the art alongside the other treatment plan.
So yeah, there are assessments that we can give, and we do have art-based assessments. And then we also have at our disposal any other psychological assessments that we can give if we've been trained or needed to be trained in those things. But because we're a new field, part of the difficulty though is that a lot of research hasn't been published necessarily. We can tell you, and we can have lots of clients tell you that they have been successful using art therapy, but there's a lack of research in some ways that shows quantifiably.
So then there's my question for you as someone who teaches this now and who has doctor in front of her name, what areas does the research need to go for this field to keep expanding?
There's a lot of different psychological theory approaches that are integrated with the art and art therapy. And I think the direction that we're moving towards and that my research goes in the direction of is trying to create a unified theory of art therapy and really understanding what happens, what are the phenomenological things that happen. And so my research right now is about, okay, so this isn't a private practice and it isn't an art studio, it's an art therapy studio. So this is what I call a liminal space. And so in that liminal space, what happens in it?
Is any of your own personal artwork, the visual journal you were describing or whatever you do when you are not acting under the auspices of an art therapist, is it ever informed? Are you processing things that you've experienced while you're here? I mean, there are a lot of people who have gone through a lot of rough times.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I have worked a lot with kids that have had pretty significant trauma, kids that are in the foster care system. And sometimes after a full day of that going home, I would literally need to like release it. And so this is just an example of something that I did, but I took a huge jar and every day I would get home, I would do a quick, you know, on a scrap piece of paper, a quick sketch or write a couple words, crumple it up and put it in my jar. It honestly really helped me, you know.
In school, we learned about response artwork. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of times that was kind of built into the program that we were in and that Emily was one of the professors for. So I'm an artist anyway, so it comes naturally to work that way. But then to put your mind into the place where you're trying to like process through whatever is going on, just I think it works itself naturally into your art process.
Does the reality of this work gel with what you were hoping when you decided to combine your interest in art and your interest in helping people?
It's even better than I imagined. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, working a lot with kids is really rewarding, and you know, having them walk in and be excited to come to therapy at 6, 7 years old makes me feel like something right's going on in there, you know. And essentially you're giving them all these different tools that they can use and transform to their own for the rest of their life, and that's pretty cool.
You have all these like aha moments and just great moments with your clients where you can see that things are clicking and they're getting things and they're moving forward. And of course there's hard days too, and sometimes you feel like it's sort of a thankless job at times. But overall, you feel that you're helping people and that they're making some progress in their life, and that's incredibly rewarding for sure.
Well, thank you to all three of you. Best of luck in your work.
Thank you. It was nice to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for being here, Mitch.
Emily Nolan, Ashley Smallwood, and Caitlin Walsh are art therapists at Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies in Bayview. We first spoke with them in June, and you can see photos from their studio at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll meet a UWM professor who is helping young refugees adjust to life in American schools. Lake Effect continues right after this short break on 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Starting a class at a new school is always a bit frightening. But starting at a new school in a new country while learning a new language, well, that can be downright terrifying.
Refugees from a myriad of countries have been resettling in Wisconsin for decades. Some come from war-torn countries like Syria or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Others are fleeing religious or ethnic persecution, like the Rohingya Muslims of Myanmar. Most have had their educations disrupted in their home countries or during their time in a refugee camp.
Coming to school after so much turmoil can be difficult, especially since many do not speak English when they first arrive. That's where Lynn Shedevy comes in. Shedevy is a professor at UW-Milwaukee who has been helping new arrivals navigate their schools in Milwaukee by creating books. She works with students from kindergarten through third grade to make picture books of their new school.
She recently spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers from a small room at Milwaukee's Academy of Chinese Language and explained why she decided to begin the program.
After the election, I found that a population who I've been an advocate for 20 years or so, the refugee population, felt defensive, felt scared. I felt protective of them because there was a lot of negative talk about refugees in general, and of course the travel ban and banning people seeking refuge here from specific places, I think sent out a negative message in general to the American public. I'm not saying everybody has that message, and I think a lot of people felt permission to act on some real negative thoughts they have about these populations. So I went to marches, I wrote letters to senators, but I kind of felt like I wasn't, that's good, I felt like I was doing something, but it didn't feel effective to me really. I just feel like one of a mass of people. I don't know if the senator is really going to read my letter, you know. I felt very powerless, and so I thought, well, I want to do something, you know, just something volunteer-wise, where I'm reaching out to this population to let them know that I validate them, I value them, I love them. That was in my, you know, out of my own personal time. So I heard about some funding where I could get some money just to get supplies to make these books with the kids. So I wrote a proposal and it was accepted. And then I have contacts in the public schools where I can connect with newcomer children, refugee children. And so I just really talked to people at different schools and said, do you have some newcomers I can work with? And that's how it all got started, really. But it kind of, you know, it just bubbled up inside me like, I gotta do something, you know?
So how long have most of these kids been here?
Well, I am attempting to work with the ones who've just come. So the group that you observed today, they're quite new. It's definitely been in the second semester I'm thinking UWM second semester. So I believe they came, you know, in the winter, I'll say January, February, something like that. Or sometimes the students have just been here this school year, so starting maybe September. You know, one thing that happens with refugee children is, and their families, is they kind of come at different times of the year. They're kind of coming and coming and coming all year long. And so I've worked with some that have just been here since November, some that got here last month. There's a group of children from Syria I'm working with at a school that got here. They've only been here, it might be 6 weeks to 2 months, something like that. So I try to find newcomers who are in that time period of, this is scary, I don't understand what anyone's saying, the food's weird, I don't get that, I'm not eating all day at school, because I'm trying to find them when they're in that zone of feeling fear and everything's so new, and working with them then.
You're making these books. Tell me a little bit about the books themselves.
I was an ESL teacher for many years, too, and I worked with the Somali population, primarily in Minnesota. They'd come to school, and everything here in the United States was very different, and they didn't really know where they were going to these different rooms all day long. That was something new. Or children hadn't been in school at all because they've been in refugee camps. So the best place to start is to use photographs of places in the school and repetitive language to talk about those places and have them take pictures of where they're going all day long. So they have some understanding or control about where they're going all day each day. So we walk around the school and take pictures of the music room and the art room and the library, the gym, the office, the bathroom for sure, the water fountain or bubbler as we say in Wisconsin, the office, their classroom, and just start to work with the vocabulary around those places. And they love going around and taking the pictures. And then we just make the book about their new school with pictures of the school and the different places they go in the school and really practice the language, especially bathroom. I want to make sure they can say bathroom. It's a book that they get to take home about their first, their new school. Often it's their very first school in the United States. So I want them to be able to take that home and hold on to that as a memory.
And that's something that you just brought up. A lot of these kids are coming from refugee camps. In general, the kids who are coming from camps, have they been to school before? How long, is there an average time that kids have been out of school?
So we do have to speak in general terms because it really depends on which refugee camp they've been in. We have found that children that are coming from Malaysia, refugee camps there, tend to have good literacy. They have been taught English to some capacity. They come with some English language knowledge, at least letters of the letters in the alphabet, for example, and they've been taught Malay. But the children that are coming from those refugee camps tend to be Rohingya from Burma, and then a variety of other backgrounds, but primarily we know that our Rohingya children tend to have some literacy. So knowing that, I approach that differently than children I know who are coming from some refugee camps in Thailand where I know there's no schooling going on, there's no reading or writing being taught. Refugee camps in Tanzania where we have some students coming from, we've found that they're coming with no literacy skills either. It kind of depends because there's so many refugee camps, different camps set up programming, but in general, compared to like our immigrant population, refugees, children come with, you know, very little literacy skills just because of, yeah, the nature of their existence before coming here. I mean, our Syrian refugees haven't been able to go to school because, you know, it's been a terrible, terrible, traumatic war situation there. So they haven't been able to even go to school.
Do you feel like your program helps bridge the gap then, kind of between a refugee camp and now suddenly school every day, 8 hours, sitting in a desk?
I'm hoping to, yes, make that connection, that very, you know, first connection with, this is your school, we're writing this, these words match this picture. And since I do some differentiation, it kind of meets the needs of the kids that come with some literacy skills and don't need quite so much support versus ones who, I've had children start to trace words, but they start at the right and head left, or start in the middle of the sentence and start tracing the words, and, you know, and then I'm realizing, ooh. So I am kind of bridging, yeah, that gap between no literacy, especially in their L1, in their first language. They don't necessarily read and write their first language either, to just introduction to literacy, like where do we write? Where do we start writing? How do we write the letters? What's the easiest way? In a context that is new, but I'm trying to make it familiar, which is their new school.
So this is a program you're really doing from UWM with MPS. Do you think this is, yes, something that MPS should try to really incorporate into the schools, like the Milwaukee Academy of Chinese Language, where there are so many refugees?
I think it would be great. Some of the ESL teachers are doing things like this already, but ESL teachers have so many children, and we don't really call it a caseload, but who they're responsible for, that doing some of these projects can be overwhelming. And also there's this kind of stress of moving the children along as quickly as you possibly can. And so it's not always realistic to be able to take time to work on these kinds of
projects, I think, that maybe you'd want to work with a smaller group. But I think it would be great. I don't think it's a secret that schools, I would say the Milwaukee Public Schools, and it's not just Milwaukee Public Schools, it's all schools, are understaffed, I would say, in terms of really, you know, how effective we can be with our English language learners. I mean, ideally, I'd like to see, it would be better for the kids if we had a lot more ESL teachers at each school. Funding does not permit that. So the reality is, you know, I, as an ESL teacher personally, I always kind of felt like I'm not doing enough. I need to spend so much more time with all of these children, and I just can't because I'm just me. That's just the reality of public education.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
You are very welcome.
Lynn Shedevy is a professor at UW-Milwaukee who's working with recent refugee kids to create books about their new schools in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and for more information, find your way to WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.